Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Gift of Grace on the Word 1220. This is Phil Giuliotti here again on another awesome Sunday evening. And this is the Gift of Grace, where we read and teach God's Word, and we proclaim the kingdom and salvation in Jesus the Messiah. So I hope you've had an awesome week. Last week, we talked about Paul's second letter to Timothy at the very end of that letter, where Paul was anticipating that his martyrdom was coming very soon, and he wrote a passage encouraging Timothy to continue in his work. Basically, Paul knew that a new generation of leaders, a new generation of teachers and preachers was now going to be coming on the scene, and that he was about to leave the scene. And I love the fact that he said that he fought the good fight, he ran the race, he kept the faith. And that's really an encouragement for all of us. Today we're going to stay in that same letter, except we're going to go a chapter earlier. And I know it's a little unusual to do Bible study this way, but this isn't really a Bible study. This is kind of a topical discussion. And this may go on for this week and next week, because in the third chapter of 2 Timothy, St. Paul writes what he could have actually written last week or last month or a couple of years ago or even a few years ago, just as well as when he did write it almost 2,000 years ago. And that has to do with what are commonly called end times events, end times scenarios. You know, there's been end times scenarios since the beginning. If you read other things that Paul writes, it sounds like he's anticipating Jesus coming back in his lifetime. Peter writes like he's expecting Jesus to come back in his lifetime. And all through history, there have been many speculations. There have been so many false teachers that have predicted an exact date and an exact time when Jesus would come back, that the world would end on a certain day at a certain time. And as I always like to say, if someone tells you a date and a time, you can be almost 100% sure that they're wrong, because Jesus himself said that no man knows the day or the hour. So if somebody gives you a day and an hour, the chances are 100% or just a shade under 100% that they're wrong. So Paul talks about this. This is 2 Timothy chapter 3. I'll give you a second to flip there. We're not going to read and cover the whole thing, but we're going to cover kind of the highlights of this, because when you read some of this, when you read these passages, and when you think about some of the possible meanings of these things, it's very applicable to our time, and it really makes you wonder about the times we're living in now, which I maintain are very exciting times. We've been put here on earth at this time for a particular reason. I was just telling a group I was teaching this morning that in Acts chapter 17, Paul points out to the Athenians on the Areopagus that all people come, I'm going to paraphrase, of course, all people come from one blood, that they are born when they're born, and they're put in the places where they're supposed to be at the time that they're supposed to be. And that is part of the overall plan. That is part of God's overall plan. So we that are here today, in this particular time, have been destined to be here today at this particular time. And there's a reason we weren't here in 1902, and there's a reason we weren't here in 1368, and there's a reason we weren't here in the year 984, because we're meant to be here now for whatever reason and for whatever part of the plan we are part of. And that's very exciting because we are here probably at a time just as exciting as the first century, where evangelists that were filled with the Spirit, that had understood the gospel, and many of whom had known Jesus personally, went into a pagan world and brought in the first harvest. We are now living in a time where we are filled with the Spirit, understand the gospel, and are going again into a pagan world to bring in the final harvest. And Paul talks about this in 2 Timothy chapter 3. And I'm just going to start reading and then probably break it and talk. Verse 1, "But know this, that in the last days perilous times will come, for men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying its power, and from such people turn away." So here we are. He tells us when this is going to happen. He says, in the last days. In the last days. Now, he doesn't know when the last days are going to be. Maybe he's thinking he's in the last days. Maybe he's thinking the last days are sometime in the future. But whenever the last days are, and the last days, of course, began when Jesus was born, as the writer to the Hebrews tells us. But that's a topic for another show. But he says, in the last days, perilous times are going to come. Not just hard times, not just inconvenient times, not just, we're not going to be as comfortable as we were before. Perilous times, dangerous times, downright scary times are going to come. Things are going to be shaken. Things are going to be different than they were. We've heard many, many, many people, many evangelists, many preachers, since COVID began, and it actually started before, but since COVID began, who have said everything that can be shaken is being shaken. And it's not just the coronavirus, it's that there's everything is being shaken. Authorities, laws, churches, governments, everything that can be shaken is shaken because there is only one unshakable kingdom. Everything else is shakable. As Isaiah points out, the nations are a drop in the bucket compared to God's eternal plan. The nations are a drop in the bucket. But he says that perilous times are going to come. The last days are going to be worse. There's going to be a different mindset. These sins that he mentions, and he mentions a long list. You can skim them over as we're talking. I want to read them again. But it's a different mindset of sin. It's a whole series of more serious problems that come from within. You know, Jesus himself in Mark chapter, seven, he says, it's not what goes into a man that defiles him, but what comes out of him. So in other words, things that come out of your heart are what defile you. Not what you eat, not what you take in, but what comes out of you. You know, he points out in other places that greed and lust and pride and murder all come from a man's heart. They're what his heart speak of. These things that defile you come out of your heart because the heart is desperately wicked, he says. Desperately wicked, a little bad once in a while. Desperately wicked. And so as this end time that Paul's talking about comes, there are going to be much more significant manifestations of these. And it's going to cause this time to be a dangerous time to live in. It's also going to be more difficult for people to keep their integrity, to live according to the dictates of their conscience, to live according to the foundation that they have in their faith and in the gospel. And we see this being fulfilled in our time. We see lawlessness, we see pride, we see greed, we see murder, we see all these things unfolding, and it is in fact shaking people's faith. Because when you couple this with Paul's letter, second letter to the Thessalonians, that the great falling away will happen, and then the man of sin will be revealed. We have seen the great falling away happen in our lifetime. We've seen this be worse and worse. We've seen times be more dangerous. And we see the government of nations not only condoning horrible sins that are abominations before God, but promoting those sins and calling them good. Calling them good. And it's a time where, although these things have always existed, and as Ecclesiastes says, there's nothing new under the sun, now is a time where the evil is being promoted and is not being held in check even by the church, is not being held in check even by the society as a whole, as it used to be in the past. So we see these biblical texts coming to life, and Paul says for sure this is going to happen. He doesn't say in the end times there might be this. He doesn't say, well, you know, it's possible that at the end time things are going to be disordered. He says perilous times will come. It is a definitive statement. There is no question in his mind. And when you read all these things, you see that it's self-love is the key and is the basis to all these things. It's selfishness. It's a self-love that is aggressive and unnatural. No respect for people, no respect for authority, certainly no respect for God and no respect for moral law, because now self-love has led us to the point where no one is going to tell us what to do and no one is going to tell us how to live. We are going to do what we want because we want to be masters of our own fate. And like everything else, you can look back on the serpent talking to Eve in the garden. And after the serpent asks Eve what the word says and then puts some doubt in her mind about did he really mean that, the clincher of this whole temptation, and this is what how Satan works, and he always uses the same strategy, and it almost always works. The clincher in the whole thing is, let me tell you why he doesn't want you to eat that, because then he's not going to be able to control you. You're not going to be living under his thumb. You're not going to be living under his domination. You're going to be a god too. Maybe you'll be a god little g, but you're going to be a god too, and you're going to be master of your fate, and you're going to control your life, and maybe you'll be able to even control things going on here. After all, in our time, all of the people that you see on TV and in the media and in the government are God's little g's, are telling us how we can control the planet and how we can control the society and how we can control even the nature of human beings and how the divine spark, the image of God that's in each person, isn't anything. It isn't even real. It's a matter of we came out of the primordial slime, and we were supercharged chimpanzees, and at one point we were supercharged amoebas, but were just a mass of chemicals that randomly assembled themselves over time and became a human being. So there is no worth, there is no individual dignity. It's all subservient to your will and to the will of the people who govern you. And the self is the center, because after all, this is what we have. This is what we have. This is where we live. We live. We love our carnal selves. We love our bodies. We're free. Just absolutely, I don't even know what the word is, obsessed with our health. You can't watch TV for 2 minutes without a commercial about a medication or some disease process. Everybody's walking around hydrating themselves, even at middle of January when it's 10 degrees outside. Everyone is concerned about every freckle that they have. Everybody's concerned about every pain that they have. And they don't even think about their spiritual selves. When I was working, I commonly said to people, because I had made the observation over time, after becoming a believer, that people spent more time worrying about their cholesterol than where they were going to spend eternity, because they never gave a thought to eternity. They wanted to take care of themselves. They wanted to gratify whatever they could gratify themselves in, whatever gave them pleasure, whatever gave them some perceived security. I can take care of all that. All that is within me. And that passage there from 2 Timothy 4 basically says, I am all that really matters. I'll make provision for what I need, for what I want. And it's power, and it's money, and it's greed, and it's lust, and it's whatever it is. I'm going to take care of that. And that is my right to do that. So Paul says this is going to be the mentality of the end times. You know, whenever I read that, I think back, and I don't want to talk about it now, but I think back to the passage in the Gospels where Jesus says, when the Son of Man returns, will he find faith on the earth? And I never really thought about that years ago, but now as time goes on, I think about that more and more. When he comes back, how much faith is he going to find on the earth? And what is faith? The people that go to church for 57 minutes a week? The people that say a prayer once every few months? The people that say a prayer when they're in some kind of predicament, some kind of danger? The people who give God a passing thought from time to time? This is the time that we're living in. Because at the expense of our spiritual life, at the expense of what God expects us to do and how he expects us to live, we want to take care of ourselves. We want to take care of things the way we want to take care of things. We will be our own masters. We have now evolved the things that he says in his word. The things that he has said in the church are just ancient superstitions, and they were put there by people who were primitive in their thought, weren't scientific, and now we've evolved. Now we'll decide who's going to be born, who's not going to be born, who can be married, whether you can change your gender, whether you can live together in any combination of groups and say that that's a family, we'll decide that. And the perilous times that Paul talks about are here. Now, why are they perilous? Who cares? Let people do whatever they want. Well, they're perilous because these things have to be answered for. These things are going to bring judgment. You know, Ruth Graham, Billy Graham's wife, many years ago, I don't know, I think she probably passed away 20 years ago, but quite a few years before that, she said, if God does not judge America, he'll have to apologize to Sodom and Gomorrah. well, look how many things have happened in the 20 years or so since she died. If he doesn't judge what we are doing, it's not just America, it's the whole world. If God doesn't judge us now, he's going to have to apologize to Sodom and Gomorrah. Because after all, the things that brought judgment on Sodom and Gomorrah are the things that are being glorified in our society, especially in Western society. And so all these things lead to pride and boasting. You know, in Proverbs, I can't remember the chapter offhand, maybe it's 12, I don't know. Of all the things God hates the most, a prideful look. The old King James says haughty eyes are what God hates the most. But it says in this thing that people will become, in this passage, that people will become blasphemers. They have no fear of God, no fear. They're not concerned at all for their conduct. And as their conduct becomes more and more immoral, they get worse and worse, and their consciences don't even react anymore. Paul points out their consciences are seared. In other words, they're burned out. They're burned away. Their consciences don't even react. They're ungrateful. People today are ungrateful. They have no idea that they've had blessings from God, what we would call common grace. You know, Jesus said, well, it rains on the just and the unjust. Those are common blessings. People have no idea of such a thing. The gifts that he has given people have been abused. The love that he bestows on people and the love that he has made between human beings have been corrupted into lust, immorality, changes in marriage, total loss of self-control. He says even relations between parents and children are affected by this. And it goes back to Isaiah chapter 5. I'm not going to turn there because the time is going, but we know in Isaiah 5 it says, woe to you when you call evil good and good evil. Boy, turn your TV on for 5 minutes. When you substitute darkness for light and light for darkness, when you substitute bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. In other words, opposite things, the things that are not to be glorified are being glorified. The things that are horrible, despicable, and shameful are what are being called good. And in Isaiah 5, the prophet writes, woe to you when you do this. We have a government in this country, very prominent leaders who say, well, to restrict access to abortion is a sin. Is a sin. A sin. To prevent a woman from killing her baby in any way is a sin. This is what we've come to. This is Isaiah 5 in real time. So everything is affected by this. So the immoral things are natural and they're accepted. And the voice of the church, which should be thundering against these things, is quiet. It's barely noticeable. In fact, it isn't noticeable. Even if you go into the church building, it's not noticeable, let alone if you're outside the church building. You don't hear a word. You don't hear an objection. You don't hear, oh, people, you might want to think about this in light of the scriptures and what you know about Judeo-Christian morality. No, you don't hear a word. And so the time is perilous from that point of view. And next week, we're going to talk about this line about they have a form of godliness, but they don't have its power. They look nice. Like the Pharisees looked nice. We have plenty of religious leaders who look very nice, but they have no power. There's not any divine power working in them. The shepherds have sat down and don't care if the wolves are eating the sheep. In fact, they're encouraging the wolves to eat the sheep. So these are, in fact, perilous times. Oh, I know the music's playing. Whoa. Well, thanks for joining us, and come back again next week on The Gift of Grace, where we're going to read and teach God's Word, and we're going to continue probably in 2 Timothy chapter 3. Have a great week.